I want to welcome you all to the Second Court of Appeals. You're our only oral argument set for this afternoon. I understand that the appellant has filed a redacted brief and reply brief in answer to our concerns, and so the only thing that I would caution counsel is during oral argument, if you would use the children's initial or make up a fake name that matches the first letter of their names, just so we don't inadvertently do something that might identify these children on the record. So before we get started, I'll introduce the panel you have today. To my left is Justice Dana Womack. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So if everyone is ready to proceed, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Charles Ray Gary versus the state of Texas. May it please the board. Ms. Aubrey Demeron will argue for the appellant. Mr. David Singleton will argue for the state.
Okay. You may proceed.
The main issues of the appellant today revolve around extraneous evidence and that came into this trial. There's a long history of extraneous evidence in the case law, as you know. The proper use of extraneous evidence has been limited so that it doesn't bring in the character of the defendant because it has a prejudicial effect.
But doesn't 38.37 act as an exception to that general rule?
Absolutely, Your Honor, it does. I do think, though, that 3837 has to be used with caution. And all the case law that I could find that examined the constitutionality of 3837 said it was specifically because of the safeguards that are in place to protect the procedural rights. And
aren't those rights forfeitable, though?
Yes, Judge, they are. Most of them are. I do think that the constitutional right to a fair trial is not forfeitable or waivable. And I do think that comes up as an issue today. And the main issues that brings that about were not forfeited and were preserved. The issue is that the defendant was essentially tried for two different cases, two different girls, two different indictments. I think the biggest challenge is the two different indictments were discussed in the trial. So in the jury instructions, when it refers repeatedly to the indictment, that brings question to which indictment.
Well, okay, so reading the jury charge as a whole, I thought when you got to paragraph 6, it made it pretty clear that they were just to focus on the allegations involving M and not J. And even in the defendant's own closing argument, that point was made very clearly that, and the state made it and defense made it, that, you know, the jury was not there today to consider anything about the indictment involving J. Is that a fair understanding?
Yes, Justice. My concern is that the state's rebuttal to Mr. Isaac's argument was, and if you don't mind, I'll read it straight from the record. Mr. Isaacs says that J.C. has nothing to do with this case. Well, that's absolutely wrong, okay? Obviously, the judge would not let this testimony in if it did not have a bearing on this case. I do agree that correctly states the law, but I think it could tend to confuse the jurors, especially when we have in the definitions of the charge that the sexual abuse could be for multiple victims. Additionally, in the second to last paragraph, right before the jury is sent to consider the charge, the state again emphasizes, we have corroborating evidence that this happened, and you got to watch those kids. Don't send that message that brands these two girls. These kids, it's repeatedly talked about as a whole, and I think that brings an issue if the jury was not clear that they could only base the only basis of the conviction could be based on indicted charges, not these extra charges that were discussed. And I do think that the similarity of the cases draws confusion, and case law has reflected that the more similar the cases are, the more likely there is to be confusion among a jury.
So would you be okay if let's say that that Mr. Gary had not been indicted for anything involving Jay, but the same testimony came in, she testified, everything was the same except for the fact that there wasn't an actual indictment, would you have any problem with that coming in?
Your Honor, I think there's still this issue of confusion. There are multitudes of cases that discuss that when there's similar extraneous evidence, it brings to a greater difficulty. I think the other issue here is how much of the case was spent on testimony involving J.C. And, in fact, another issue is that the testimony involving J.C. was more heinous than that of M.C., the
indictment. Did you ever ask the trial court to do a 403 balancing?
Your Honor, I wasn't at the...
When I say you, I'm not talking about you personally.
not explicitly, Your Honor. And another thing that I think was an issue that we've raised is that there was not a hearing held. And
Let me ask you just one procedural question. There's a motion called Defendant's Written Objection to Admissibility of Extraneous Offenses, Request for Procedural Determination by Trial Court with Findings of Fact and Conclusions of Law and for Limiting Instruction. Did y'all ever get an order on that?
Yes, Judge. I believe that I have the record. It's in my reply brief. I went through each of the orders.
But in your reply brief in the chart, there's no order
there's
with
no
respect
order.
To that.
Then we may not have gotten in. Your Honor, I believe you're correct that there was not an order signed on that
Thank
one.
You.
Yeah, no, there was an order about the limiting instruction that was requested to be in the charge, but as I understand it, trial counsel didn't have any objections to the charge other than a sufficiency argument on one aspect of the conduct. Is that?
Yes, Your Honor, I did not see additional objections. And I think the case law is clear that you can raise jury charge instructions for the first time on appeal.
Oh, sure.
And I do think that there's an issue in this particular case. I don't think you can say there's any issues with 3837 across the board. The court's been clear on that. But in this particular case, with the extra offense being so similar, with it being somewhat confusing on the times and dates because they're so interwoven, and the likelihood that the jury can confuse it, in addition to the fact that the testimony of J.C. was more extreme than that of M.C., it makes it likely that inflamed the jury, made them more likely to act on an emotional or irrational basis in their determination or in their punishment. I think it's interesting to note that the defendant received the maximum sentence. As I'm sure you've heard testimony, this is not the most heinous crime that I've come across, and I'm sure you haven't, and certainly in case law, of sexual abuse and continuous sexual abuse of a child. I think it is somewhat indicative that the jury may have relied on this extra evidence and the emotion involved to come up with the verdict, the punishment, or both.
But isn't a jury entitled to consider all of that if it's properly admitted under 3837?
Yes, Your Honor, but we also want to protect against false or extreme punishments that are based on irrational or offenses. I mean, the whole foundation of our system and the whole rule basis for Rule 404 and our system is that a defendant should only be convicted on a proper basis, on the basis of the allegations for which he's indicted, not for extra crimes. And as you've recognized in case law, there's a tendency for juries to rely emotionally on those things and base their punishment not just on the crime in front of them, but on what they hear outside of that.
But the legislature's made that balance here with 3837.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the concern is that the safeguards weren't all thoroughly followed.
But my problem is, how did you put the trial court to the task of making sure those safeguards were followed?
Your Honor, I think that the objection to JC's testimony should have been gone into more when Mr. Isaacs raised his objection. The objection with due process does bring into the equation the whole basis of the due process claim is the foundation that propensity evidence is coming in. And so the propensity evidence then raises this relevance. What relevance does it have to this case?
I find that very subtle, a very subtle reading of the objection that was actually lodged and upon which defense counsel obtained the running objection. So maybe you can help me understand how an equal protection argument subsumes within it in a way that's clear to everybody the relevance and all the other problems that you see with the evidence.
Your Honor, I think this was brought up in the context of the motion in limine, and the motion in limine was to keep the extraneous evidence out. So it was broader than just the due process clause and the equal protection. I think the equal protection itself, the right at issue in his equal protection argument is this propensity element coming in, and why it serves as an issue to the defendant and makes the case unfair. He does specifically use the words so that the defendant can receive a fair trial.
But hasn't the constitutionality of 3837 been litigated already in the courts?
Yes, Judge. But again, I think the issue is that they make sure all of the cases that I could find that talk about the constitutionality refer again to the requirements of notice and a hearing. Here we didn't ever have a hearing. And then the objection to the evidence really should have been addressed more to consider whether the extraneous evidence could come in. I think that's my concern in this case, is at what point, by overlooking these procedural requirements, do we end up having inequitable results and perhaps false or extreme verdicts or punishment because we don't hold a hard line to these procedural requirements that are the foundation of the constitutionality of 3837.
Thank you.
I would also like to point out to the court as far as the same testimony, I do think that the issue there, again, specific to this case, was that the testimony relied upon by the same nurse to share what the two girls said was based on a medical history that she did not need or use for diagnosis or treatment. The record makes clear that she had already received that information from mom in the presence of the girls. There was no indication then that they had any feeling that they needed to be truthful because they were present for the nurse hearing the explanation from their mother. Additionally, the record is clear that the same nurse did not use their testimony for diagnosis and treatment. The tests she performed were for tests that could not be passed in a way that the girls had testified to. She tested for gonorrhea and chlamydia that cannot be passed through saliva or touch. And those were the only words that the children used, or the only allegations that the children have. So she did not rely on their statements for her treatment. I think that's key in getting around the hearsay objection, is that it's used for diagnosis and treatment. So I do think that that also...
It's reasonable to test an 8-year-old who's allegedly been through something like this for a sexually transmitted disease?
Yes, Your Honor, I do think it's reasonable, but I don't think that gets us around what the proper testimony should be. And I don't think that if the testing is going to be done automatically, then what reason do we have, does a patient have to be honest? If the doctor's testing is going to be automatic, then there's no more motivation for the honesty. which in my understanding of the case law is the reason that it gets around the hearsay exception. I do think that the same testimony was pertinent because that was the reason that the it appears from the record that the objection to the jury charge was sustained by the judge was the testimony of the same nurse that came in. And for those reasons, we would respectfully ask the court to reverse and remand.
Thank you very much.
Dry throat.
It's that time of year.
Yeah, I should be able to get through. I would start out by pointing out that the issue of your error preservation is systemic. Even if it's not raised, the court on the first level of appeals has an independent duty to examine that. And that's our first line of defense, that none of the first five or six, everything but the last point of error was clearly not preserved. The motion that is referred to, if you go back and look at the motion, it says, it objects to very clearly, and I have the language, well, I know the language, evidence admitted at 401, 402, 403, and that's it. And then it goes on to say, the evidence should not be admitted until it's established what purpose is being admitted for, and that it, for that it's a purpose other than the character of the defendants or the tendency to act in conformity with that character. Well, number one, nothing in there tells the trial judge that this is a 3837. To the contrary, 3837B2B says the evidence may be admitted, and I'm skipping, but for any bearing the evidence has on relevant matters, including the character of the defendant and acts performed in conformity with the character of the defendant. So everything about the motion talks about 404B. It does not talk about 3837. Both sides have written in their brief on multiple occasions the purpose of an objection is to raise the issue in a sufficiently clear matter to the judge so that he can address it. Nothing in this motion directs the judge's attention to the fact that this is a 3837 objection. Now, when Mr. Isaacs is granted a running objection, it is important because if you go back and look at that testimony, I think it's in our brief, he begins by saying, I think 3837 purports to allow this testimony. He's telling the judge, I think it comes in. That makes it almost impossible to argue that the prior motions were objections to 3837. But he goes on to make the only argument that he makes, and that is that it violates equal protection. And the arguments that are being raised on appeal do not comport with the arguments that were made at trial. So I think for numerous reasons, and the other reason, which is very important, if you look at the very end, and I admit that this was a brief, it wasn't an official pretrial hearing, but it was a brief hearing that occurred after the jury was all shown up and before they began the trial proper and commenced the voir dire. And there's a little bit of arguing back and forth, and the judge, his final statements are, look, the motions in limine are in place, and I think that tells you what the judge understood the argument to be referring to, and it's axiomatic that motions in limine do not preserve error. He says we will deal with this when the situation arises, all right? And he says that very clearly. And he says at this point, your motion and the, or your objection, and the last one being the only objection he had made, which was to equal protection, is overruled. Then the jury comes in, and he says there may, he instructs the jury, there may be some other evidence coming in. If that happens at that time, I'll give you some instructions. So clearly, the matter was not settled. Both sides agree that you have to object every time the evidence is introduced, and the record clearly shows there's no 403B objection or a 403 objection. There's no objection that, hey, this was a hearing, but it wasn't conducted properly. There was no objection at the time that the evidence was introduced. You know, we need a hearing outside the hearing of the jury. Defense counsel says early on, I think 3837 purports to allow this. There is no way that a judge is going to understand this to be a 3837. And that's the responsibility of the defendant. That's the responsibility, and that's the burden of proof that the appellant carries right now. With that said, even if we toss all that aside and say, yeah, somehow magically the error was preserved, and I don't mean to be dismissive, even if we argue, assuming arguendo, that the error is preserved, we get to the request for the jury instruction. The jury instruction, if you read it, is a 404B, a limiting instruction. That doesn't apply in this case. Number two, when you didn't object to the evidence coming in at the time that it came in, every case that I could find says it's now admitted for all purposes. So again, you're not entitled to that instruction. And we quote the Texas Supreme Court explaining the reason you don't get that instruction when you fail to ask for the limiting instruction at the time is because it just creates too much confusion in the mind of the jury. Now they're having to think back maybe a day, 2 days, 3 days, depending on when the testimony came in, to think back, but they've had all this time to think about it. You can't wait until the last minute and then say, hey, we want an instruction now. But again, emphatically, the instruction that they're asking for is a 404B instruction. It's not one that is particularly applicable here. As to the issue of Rule 403, the only way that the appellant can prevail on this and the next one, which is the admission of the medical records, is if they could show an abuse of discretion. And this court starts out with a presumption that the ruling was correct. And they give great deference to the court in making its decision. And that's especially important when it comes to the medical records. Here, at this point, look at what the judge had in mind. First of all, or had before him, the defendant had already said, yes, by counsel, yes, I believe it comes in. If he did hold a hearing, even if it was an inadequate hearing, the court is not required to run through its reasons for admission. There is an absolute presumption that if the objection is raised, that the court considered that. In this case, and I say that because there was one line in, I think, their initial brief that suggested that there was a hearing, which I assume refers back to the pretrial hearing. but assuming that there is no objection, look at what the judge had before him. The defense had questioned the credibility of the victim and pointed out the absence of any physical corroborating evidence. He had done that. He had indicated he was going to do that. He indicated it in his opening arguments. Before the trial started, the state said, second, the defendant intends to call a witness, being the daughter, to testify about the defendant's character for not being a child molester. In other words, she's going to say it's her opinion that her dad is not a child molester. That alone makes this absolutely the 3837 highly, highly, highly probative. It was a single witness case. And again, Mr. Isaacs does a great job of pointing this out, you know, that there is no evidence. The same nurse really couldn't produce any hard physical evidence. And it all boils down to this one little girl, and this is a serious charge, and you're going to put my guy in prison forever based on her charge. And his argument is that's enough or that's not enough. The focus of both his opening and closing arguments were on the fact that there's no physical evidence. Mr. Gary had given a confession, but that had been suppressed, and so the only thing we have absent the sister's testimony was the victim's testimony. It becomes now kind of what we would call a he said, she said. And this, if you look at, and I quoted it indirectly, both the legislative history and the opinion in the Austin court in Ernst versus State, the courts have long recognized that these kind of cases are very difficult cases because they often boil down to he said, she said type situations.
Well, that brings me to a question. So this is really he said, she said, another she said. In light of the extensive testimony about JC as an extraneous offense and the fact that the charge does say commits two or more acts of sexual abuse, regardless of whether they're committed against one or more victims, is it possible that the jury might have considered JC's testimony improperly?
Well, let me offer two responses to that, why I don't think that that's likely. The charge made it very, very clear. The indictment, when the trial first starts up, the jury hears the indictment, and it's only the victim. They hear the state's opening, and the state says, so next morning the victim's mother had a talk with all three of her girls, and specifically because this case is about MC. MC, she goes by MC, all right? Right on. I mean, first thing the jury hears is this case is about MC. Defense's opening, I won't do it, but I've got 1, 2, 3 quotes from them that say, you know, this case is not about her. If they could prove it, bring a case against her. This case is only about her, the victim, not the sister. In closing argument, 1, 2 times he argues it. The state responds, but let me give you the rest of what the state said. Yes, the state said, because the defense will say, why are we hearing about the sister? Because that's not relevant. And the state goes, well, obviously that's absolutely wrong. That doesn't have anything to do with the case. And he goes on, being it is relevant to prove that the defendant also molested the victim. And he makes that clear. He says you can consider it as long as we prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. The charge in multiple places makes it very clear that you can only convict if you find that the victim, not the sister, was the one who was molested. And I don't see it here, but I believe it's in my brief. Although the sister was up there testifying for quite some period of time, all right, there were about 5 pages of the judge going through and asking her questions to make sure that she understood that what was going on and what was expected of her. He invited both counsel, if you want to ask her any questions, go ahead and ask her. Then her testimony is presented through an anatomical doll, and I do need to find that. And that, if you go back and read the record, it's very slow, because page after page, what do you call this part? What do you call that part? What do you call this part? This is pages and pages that are really just setting up. It's not saying anything has particularly happened. And when you get to actual testimony regarding the events and what happened to her, and I apologize, I get up here and I can't find anything. I want to say, and again, you'll find that in our brief, I think it's only like 14 or 15 pages. And while it's true, her testimony goes on for a long time. Not all of it, only a small part of it, is actually dealing with what happened. And I think it kind of exaggerates it if you look at the whole time she's up there testifying as opposed to when she's actually describing what happened. But again, this is a situation, this is the very situation, the very reason why the legislature adopted this, because of the difficulty in these cases. A lot of defense attorneys are very successful in cases where there's no physical evidence, which frankly is most of the cases, and in cases, and in these cases, there's almost never an eyewitness to what happened. And because of the seriousness of the crime and because of the difficulty in proving them, they made this decision. And they said, you're supposed to have this procedure, and I agree. The law says, or the cases that are out there say it's constitutional because there are these safeguards in place. But every case that I'm aware of that has addressed this says you can waive it. And again, I have to go back to defense counsel's statement. I think 3837 purports to allow this. And he did not pursue it because he thought it was admissible. Oh, as to the same nurse, there was abundant testimony there, and again, we've set that out in our brief. And this was not a quick decision by the judge. If you look at the record, the objection came up. The judge excused the jury for lunch, gave both sides a chance to go out and pull case law, came back, went over the case law, let both of them argue extensively back and forth as to why this is right, why it isn't. Then they put the same nurse up there to testify, and she testified, yes, it is important. The diagnosis is part of the treatment, and it tells me where I have to look. It tells me what tests I have to do, and we've produced, I think, a number of cases that almost every time this issue, not every time, but I think the overwhelming majority of times that any court of appeals has addressed this issue on less evidence than what is before the court right now, they have found that it's admissible. And again, I have to point out, it's not only that it's standard procedure, it's not only that it is important for these reasons, but she also specifically testifies, in this case, I used it to determine what tests to administer, to determine what areas of the body. Again, you start out with the presumption that the court is correct. This was not a decision that was lightly made. It was carefully profusely argued by both sides. Evidence was introduced on the top of it. The judge was in the unique position of watching the jury, of watching the attorneys, of watching the trial. And he drew a conclusion based on that testimony that it was admissible. And frankly, if you accept the testimony at face value, I think it has to be admissible. The only way to say it's not is to go behind and second guess and say, well, no, the same nurse testified that it's common practice, that it is part of the treatment, and that it specifically was part of the treatment in this case. You have to go back and set that aside, and those are conclusions that clearly made. So
I just had one question. Yes, with regard to the running objection that was granted by the trial court, what then did that preserve?
The running objection, my reading is, and I went and pulled it up again here a few moments ago, and I will also be very honest. That pretrial hearing was kind of unclear. But if you go back and don't look at what I quote, go back to the reply brief and see their record references to the running objection, and it's to the equal protection objection. Even if it were not, what other objection could it be to? A 404B objection? I went through the clerk's record, and I did a text search for 3837, and the only reference, the only document that I found in there was the state's notice of intent to offer evidence under 3837. Again, it's the opponent, the defendant in this case, their responsibility to clearly apprise the court what my objection is, because that's the only way that you can give the court an opportunity to correct it. And I will point out one more thing. Assume I'm absolutely wrong, that the judge gave him a running objection. You still have the problems. When the testimony comes in, there's no request for a contemporaneous instruction. When the jury charge takes place, there's no request for any of the things that are being complained of here. There's only one objection made, and that's got nothing to do with the issues that are before the court right now. Even if you had the running objection, you know, I think it was forfeited later on, because you have a continuing objection to, you know, make sure if you're right and I've got that objection, well, judge, this came in, give him a limiting instruction.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I can't understand if the objection is determined to be solely on an equal protection, what he would actually be objecting to. I think looking in context with the 3837, the motion in limine that's just been brought up, it can't be just for equal protection. It just doesn't make any sense. It has to be for the underlying issue that the equal protection is addressing. And he was objecting specifically to extraneous testimony of JC.
Well, but okay, so I've got that page in front of me. So Mr. Isaacs said, Your Honor, I think 38.37 does purport to allow that. However, we're going to object to that testimony in that I believe it violates the Equal Protection Clause of both the United States Constitution and the State Constitution by creating a subclass of citizens. And it seemed pretty clear to me that that's the way the trial court understood it, because he did say that he would give the defense a running objection on that.
Yes, Your Honor, and he went on to say that he wouldn't have to object when that extra testimony came in. And
on equal protection grounds.
And again, I think it's really difficult to go back and determine from the record what exactly he understood. It's hard for me to understand what the actual equal protection is if it's not. His example goes through and talks about bringing in extraneous evidence.
It's hard for you to understand. How is it apparent to the trial court?
And looking at the record, I wish it had been more articulate. And, you know, we're left to look at what we have before us. I think the challenge is, do we ultimately have a fair trial? Do we ultimately have a verdict that was based on the indicted charge? And that's where I think there is question and where there might be harm.
What about the state's argument that even if you assume that the running objection covered everything under the sun that the defense wanted to complain about, as I understand the state's point, is that even with that running objection, there still needed to be a request for a limiting instruction at the time that evidence came in and every time it came in?
Yes, ideally there would have been a limiting instruction request when the evidence came in. I still think there's an issue, though, of the discretion of the judge letting all of the evidence in carte blanche without holding the hearing, without determining whether it should come in, and ultimately, when it has come in, making sure that the jury charge is clear, that they cannot convict on these other offenses. I disagree with the state that the evidence should be admitted for all purposes. That's not what the statute says. It says it's bearing on.
Well, I didn't notice that your reply brief addressed the state's argument on page 22 of its brief, citing Delgado versus State for the proposition that when evidence is admitted without a contemporaneous limiting instruction, it is admitted for all purposes. Do you disagree that that's what Delgado holds?
Your Honor, I still think that there is some requirement to make sure that the jury understands that they can only convict on the indicted charges, that they have to understand that these extraneous offenses, when they come in, have to be limited. You can't have a conviction based on these extraneous offenses. And whether they properly or improperly came in, we still have a responsibility to protect the integrity of the verdict. And if there's not the safeguards to make sure the jury understands that the only basis for a correct verdict is what's in the indictment of this case, I think just formatting-wise, if you look at the jury charge, there's not a clear separation of here are your instructions and here is your application. It's just paragraph-oriented, and I think that could be very confusing to a jury who doesn't see this every day, of which part is the part to apply and which part is the part that refers to these other indictments and refers to multiple victims. And especially in light of the argument that they just heard from the state, these girls, both girls, all of these offenses, and then even just from a practical standpoint of these allegations are very similar. They overlap. When you first hear the indictment, before you've seen a face, is it realistic to think that the jury was separating out the testimony of JC and MC at the time that they heard the indictment?
Thank you, Counsel. Your time's up.
Thank you.
Counsel, your case is submitted. We appreciate your coming for oral argument. It's been very